Great pleasure to see so many people here. To hear this, what I'm sure is going to be a remarkable lecture by a remarkable man, Professor Gerd Gigerenzer. I'm astonished that it's the first time, as I believe it is, that he's spoken at the LSE, because he represents so many of the interests of this school, though combining them in the way in which few people have, ranging from probability and statistics to economics to psychology to actual practice in the world of social affairs in public policy. Many of you know a lot about Gigerenzer, more than I do, I suspect. He came, as it were, from the left field. I was astonished when 10, 15 years ago I started hearing about this remarkable research he was doing, approaching the subject of rationality in a completely different way, looking not at how people ought to think, or even entirely at how they do think, but why they think in the ways they do in the circumstances in which they are discovered to be doing that. And that was a very different tradition from the work, for example, of Kahneman and Tversky, the famous psychologists, United States psychologists, who had made us all feel rather gloomy about human rationality by arguing that, and with demonstrations, that humans are continually subject to rather pathetic cognitive illusions, that they make mistakes all the time, that they just can't get it right. Well, what Gerd Gigerenzer has done is, to some extent, to redeem common sense and to redeem the ways in which people think. And I think it's characteristic of the man that, in fact, he is an optimist about people, about what they can do and the ways they approach the world. And I won't say that Kahneman and Tversky are necessarily pessimists, but that contrast reminded me of a passage from a book which I've had in my library a long time, written in 1765, which contrasts two approaches to human nature. And I thought with Professor Gigerenzer here, we should pay attention to it. Can you read that? This is from a book called by John Gregory called Human and Animal Faculties, published in 1765. And he said, human nature has been considered in different and opposite lights. Some have painted it in a most amiable form and carefully shaded every weakness and deformity. They've represented vices foreign and unnatural to the human mind. The human understanding has been thought capable of penetrating into the deepest recesses of nature, the human power capable of imitating her works. Such views are generally embraced by those who have good hearts and happy tempers, by those who love science and have an ambition to excel in it. Others have represented human nature as a sink of depravity and wretchedness. They've represented the human understanding as weak and short-sighted, the human power is feeble and extremely limited. Such representations are greedily adopted by men of narrow and contracted hearts and of very limited genius, who feel within themselves the justness of the description. Now, I'm very happy to welcome a man with a good heart and a happy temper who loves science and who feels within himself the justness of the first description. He'll speak, Professor Gigerenzer will speak for, I think, nearly an hour. We'll follow that with a brief commentary by Daniel Reed from our own operations research department, and then we'll have at least half an hour's discussion. In case anybody, I'm sure they won't, should think of leaving early, let me tell you there'll be a reception afterwards for everybody upstairs on the fifth floor with wine and some refreshments. But now it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Gigerenzer.
Some years ago in Stanford, I was lunching with a motley group of colleagues, mostly economists and psychologists. We talked about the latest news about game theory and about stubborn human irrationality. Finally, one of the economists concluded this discussion with the following dictum. Look, he said with the conviction of an economist, either reasoning is rational or it's psychological. This opposition between the rational and the psychological has haunted me ever since. And much the economist, what he meant with this was, on the one side, the beautiful system of expected utility maximization, the axioms by Savage, that jointly model utility and subjective probability, the Bayesianism, and on the other side, you. Humans that do not follow these axioms and reason in a different way. As you know, the many have tried to deal with this situation in various ways. There is the as-if conjecture, so that has been put forward by many people. So these models do not actually model the processes. We just predict what people do, so they behave just as if they would maximize. Yeah? There is another conjecture, which is, oh, so bad for the people, the irrationality, so they're full with cognitive illusions. Today, I will introduce you to a different view, which challenges the idea that rationality would be only one thing, like Bayesianism, expected utility maximization. I will try to introduce you to the study of the adaptive toolbox. That is, the study of fast and frugal heuristics and their building blocks, and in a sense, the study of human rationality, the fast and frugal way. I will begin with two examples. One is about bees and the other about balls. And they will illustrate two fast and frugal heuristics.
Okay.
I have a conflict here. There was no microphone like this. I have either hold this or be there. We'll see how I manage this. Okay. How do honeybees make decisions? Now, some biologists just say they maximize the expected utility, and it's not clear whether it's their genes or individuals or the hive's utility. Now, how do they do it, and how can we study this? Each early summer, the queen, with about half the workers, leaves the hive, and they fly some distance, and they hang on a tree like here in order to make an important decision. So where, it's a real estate problem. Yeah? So where to find a new hive? So the queen leaves back the young queen with the other half of the workers. This is about 10,000 bees. What they do is they send out some 100 scout bees, and the scout bees fly out and come back and signal with their waggle dance the location and the distance of a potential new home. Since I have a very honorable guest here, which is my daughter, who's sitting here, and she loves waggle dances, I have a waggle dance for her. So what you can see is, in the middle, the bee does an 8 and signals with the dance the distance and the direction. Here is what you can observe over the course of about 2 days. Mm-hmm. At 11 o'clock, the bees, the scout bees, they have discovered several locations. The locations are A, B, C, and D. And you can see the arrows represent the distance, the length of the arrows, and the width of the arrows, the number of bees who dance for this. The favorite location is A at this time. And you can see it changes over the time. By the end of the first day, no single bee dances anymore for A, but the favorite locations are B and G. The following day, things shift, and at the very end, it's interrupted by rain, where they have to stop decision making, and at the very end, you see there is a consensus for location G. And the queen and all the bees take off and to their new future home. Now the question is, how do bees make this decision? How do they find the location? And how do they reach consensus? Tom Seeley has marked individual bees like soccer players with numbers on the back in order to find out what exactly they are doing. And here is the bee's heuristic for choosing a future home. The first surprise was that the scout bees do not look up multiple locations, but only one. So they have no comparison about various locations. They come back and indicate with their waggle dance the location, and the duration of the dance corresponds to the overall quality of the location they're dancing for. Next they stop dancing, and they tune out, they leave the dance floor, and seem to forget the location they danced for. And finally, they come back on the dance floor and imitate the next neighbor. Wherever this next neighbor is dancing to, they are dancing to. Of course, in reality, it's not as simple as here, because only 80% of the bees, for instance, visit only one location. There's always some variability in nature, but that's the key heuristic. And you can see that this combination between just looking up one alternative, forgetting, and imitating can lead to finding a very good location, because there's a correlation between the length of the dance and the quality. And because of the forgetting and the imitation, there's some chance that bees who drop out will imitate a bee that is dancing for a good location. Of course, this is a frugal heuristic. They look up just one. It's not a very fast one. It takes them about 2 days or so to perform this. So here is an illustration of a heuristic which uses the fact of distributed intelligence. So it only works if there is many members, and each of these members, which is poorly informed, nevertheless allows by this heuristic that collective wisdom emerges from the poorly informed masses. Let me give you a second example now about individual decision making and humans. Humans are interested in balls, at least men. And so imagine you would want to build a robot that can catch balls, as in cricket, baseball, or soccer, depending on the nationality of your robot. So balls that come in high. How would you do this? And here are two visions. One is the vision with which the classical artificial intelligence started. The vision is a demonic vision, that is, try to give the robot a complete representation of its environment and the biggest computer you can afford, so that it can compute from its information the path of the ball and then run there and catch it. Okay. If you follow up this vision, just to give you an example of what you would have to do, you probably would have to feed the robot the family of all parabolas, because real balls fly in parabolic trajectories. In order to choose the right parabola, the robot would have to know the initial distance, the initial velocity, and the initial impulse, the angle which the ball was thrown or kicked. But it's still not done, because in the real world, balls do not fly in parabolas because there's wind and air resistance. So you would have to equip the robot with an additional set of measurement instruments that could measure, say, the direction and the speed of the ball at each point of the ball's trajectory to calculate where it will land and go there. That's basically the vision, and it also explains why there are no robots that can catch balls. But there is a different vision. The different vision is about heuristics. And the question is there a heuristic that can, without all of this knowledge, achieve the goal? And how can one find these heuristics? By, for instance, observing experienced players. McLeod and Dienes have done exactly this. And they have identified a heuristic that experienced players use in order to catch a ball. So the heuristic is the following. When a ball comes in high, the player starts running. And he or she fixates the ball. And the heuristic is to adjust your running speed so that the angle of gaze, the angle between the eye and the ball, remains constant. That's all. And here is an illustration. So, do you want to see it again? The only thing the player has to attend to is the angle of gaze and keeps it constant. This is now a different type of heuristic, which does not build on distributed intelligence. It builds on a very interesting feature, namely, on it changes the structure of the environment. What it does is basically it makes the path of the ball linear. And if it's linear, it will come to you and you can catch it, or at least it will hit you. And so it changes the structure, the relationship between the individual and the outside world, and helps to make any kind of curved ball coming into a simple linear structure. And also, the heuristic has a very interesting feature relative to the framework that I just explained about artificial intelligence. It goes completely out of the search space. It ignores all the relevant causal variables and does something different. It doesn't just reduce them, it ignores each of the causally relevant variables like initial speed, distance, wind, or spin. So these are two examples of heuristics. The latter one is a heuristic that is very frugal. It only attends to one variable. It's what I call one reason decision making, and it's also very fast. You can do this in quickly time, fast time. Now, here is now the larger framework. Here are two visions of rationality, and the last example relates to these two visions. On the one hand, we have demons. On the other side, we have the humans. So, and that's known as bounded rationality. There are two species of demons, which are unbounded rationality and optimization under constraints. Unbounded rationality designs, unbounded rationality asks the question, how would humans behave if they would be omniscient and omnipotent? And it ignores the fact that humans have limited memory, limited time, limited resources, and so on. The key problem with unbounded rationality models, which are very popular in economics, in the social sciences, and probably the most popular model, is that, in my view, that they do not describe what actual people do, not even what philosophers do. As the following anecdote illustrates, a philosopher from Columbia once got an offer from a rival university, and he was at pains to decide whether he should stay or go, or stay or go. And a friend of him took him aside and said, just maximize your expected utility. This is what you always write and tell your students. Whereas the philosopher responded exasperated, come on, this is serious. Optimization under constraints realizes that humans are not omniscient and that they need to search for information, and that information may cost time or money. For instance, George Stigler, the economist from the University of Chicago, wrote an important and influential paper in 1961 where he sets forth the idea of optimization under constraints, and it basically means that you should search for information till the point where the further benefits of the search will become less than its costs. But even decided proponents of optimization under constraints are willing to admit that these models become mathematically and psychologically more and more demanding and complex and unrealistic, because each constraint you introduce into model, and at the same time maintaining optimization, leads to huge complex computations that at some point are no longer feasible. Herbert Simon, the father of bounded rationality, has argued that good models of rationality should respect the actual cognitive abilities and also the external pressures of real humans. Herbert Simon's model of satisficing is, I think, the most well-known. A satisficer, for instance, when she wants to buy a house, she has an aspiration level in this model and will search until she finds the first house that meets this aspiration level, stop search and go for it. There are modifications by Reinhard Selten, for instance, where the aspiration levels themselves move if you don't find anyone, things. I will talk today about another member of the adaptive toolbox, fast and frugal heuristic. The difference is dissatisfying is searching across objects. And in fast and frugal heuristic, you have some objects already given, and you search for information which one of the two you will choose. Herbert Simon. I should say that bounded rationality means many things to different people. And for instance, one thing it means is optimization under constraints. And I don't have to tell this to economists among you. It's a standard notion among economists that bounded rationality is nothing but optimization under constraints. Herbert Simon, in private conversation, once told me that he wants to sue people who reduce his concept of bounded rationality to optimization under constraints and make it more psychologically unrealistic. So that's one thing which I think bounded rationality is not. The second interpretation or the second idea of bounded rationality, which is not my idea, is that it's irrationality. And as you can see, bounded rationality, the first interpretation here, optimization of constraint, reduces this to that concept. The second one, you reduce it to the flip side of one of the two. It's just irrationality. So if someone does not make inferences according to Bayes' rule and ignores Bayes' rule, that's called irrational, without ever looking at the problem. And I will show you today one example, among many others, where violations of Bayesian thinking, that means using heuristics instead, are nothing irrational. You can do the same problem faster, more frugal, and as accurate. In a sense, this is something where I think that Herbert Simon hasn't emphasized enough, that these heuristics are not just approximations to full rationality, but one can actually show that in certain situations, a fast and frugal heuristic is not just more fast and more frugal than some optimization model, but also more accurate. And this is a very challenging fact. I will give you a few examples. In our work at the Max Planck Institute, my research group and I have studied a whole class of heuristics, and these are the heuristics in the adaptive toolbox. There are four classes here. Ignorance-based decision-making, this is situations where you can exploit the fact that you don't know something, and I will explain the recognition heuristic in a minute. Second, one-reason decision-making, and I will also give examples. These are situations like in the ball-catching example where only one reason is attended to and everything else is ignored. Third, elimination heuristics. I will not talk about this. And satisfying, I just explained these models. I will start with here introducing you in more into this research with one-reason decision-making and with fast and frugal classification. Now, you might say bees and balls, they don't really make you enthusiastic. Yeah? Here is another example that's more about life and death. A man is brought to a hospital with severe chest pains. The doctors have to make a decision, and they have to make it quickly. The decision is whether to send him into the coronary care unit or into a regular bed with telemetry. This can be a decision about life and death, because if that person gets a heart infarct later, he should be in the coronary care unit, and if not, he should not be there. It's one of the most dangerous places to be on Earth, because of secondary infections. How does one make such a decision? I will describe three ways. One is physician's intuition. And in a hospital in Michigan that colleagues of us have studied, physicians sent, do you guess what they did? They sent 90% of all patients into the coronary care unit. That's called defensive decision making. The result of this was that the care unit was overcrowded, didn't function as well, and also I mentioned there is a danger to actually the patients. So they thought about a solution to this problem, and they went for the typical solution. And the typical solution is in the world of demons, of demons that humans can handle. So they used an expert system, which consists of a chart of 50 probabilities, some 50 probabilities. You don't have to understand this here. I show you this in order to understand why physicians didn't like it. And the physicians had to select the right probabilities and insert them into a logistic regression, which most of them didn't understand what it is. And they used a pocket calculator and calculated the probability that the person will get a heart infarct or should be sent into the coronary care unit. And if the probability was above a certain threshold, it was sent there, otherwise not. Now, this method was much better than the physician's intuitions, but as I mentioned before, it was not transparent for the physicians, and they didn't like it very much. So the researchers had now a double problem. Should the diagnosis be made by physicians' intuitions, which was not very good, or by an expert system, a logistic regression, which was better, but which was intransparent for the physicians? At this point, they tried a third option. The third option was the following. They constructed a fast and frugal classification tree based on the building blocks of heuristics that we have described in a book that's called Simple Heuristics That Make Us Smart. And this tree was the following. It asked basically a few yes and no questions. So here's the heuristic. The first question is whether there is an ST segment change. That's a certain anomaly in the electrocardiogram. If there is one, then the person should be sent immediately in the coronary care unit. If not, a second question is asked, whether the primary complaints were chest complaints. If that was not the case, then the person was immediately sent into regular nursing bed, no further questions being asked. Otherwise, a final question was asked, which at the end decided whether the person will end in the regular nursing bed and the coronary care unit. Now, here's the third method. I'm on your way. Okay. this decision tree is fast and frugal in the following sense, that only one or maybe two or maybe a few more questions are asked. So the individual predictors are all dichotomized, so binary, and a decision is possible at each point of the tree. So this tree is not built on here. Okay. Now, here are the three. This is certainly a method that can be applied fast. It's frugal. It only looks up a few predictors. And it is transparent. It corresponds to physicians' intuition. That's three advantages. But how accurate is it? Now, if you would be in the situation, and be brought into the hospital. And would you want to have the allocation, your allocation be made by physician's intuition, by the expert system, or by the fast and frugal tree? Who of you would go with physician's intuition? One, two honest people. Oh, there are more coming up here. Yeah? Who of you would go with the expert system? Yeah, there are economists here. And who would go with the fast and frugal tree? Oh, I have a fan group here. Now, it's an easy question, hypothetical, but let's see what you do when you, we hope, not be in the situation. Now, here's the answer to the question, how good are these heuristics? What you see here, how good are the three strategies? What you see here is on the y-axis, the proportion of patients correctly assigned to the coronary care unit. That should be high. On the x-axis, the proportions of patients incorrectly assigned to the coronary care unit, that should be low. So an ideal strategy would be in the upper corner here. But in the real world of medicine, there is nothing like this. This is the chance diagonal. So you get this by throwing dice. Either send nobody or send everybody into the care unit or anything in between. So we want a decision strategy that is in this area, not here. So let's first see how physicians' intuitions work. You see this yellow point? The physician sent, as I mentioned before, about 90% of those who should not be in the coronary care unit in it, and about 90% of those who should be it. They are slightly below chance, but roughly around chance. How did the expert system work? And you see the expert system was considerably better than the physicians. The reason why there are more than one point is because you can set the threshold for the probability that's being calculated and to any level, and then you can balance the two possible errors that's here. So, but everything that's here is very good. Now, how accurate was the fast and frugal heuristic? Here is the tree, and the importance of the tree is up there. Now, how can this be that a heuristic that has less information than an expert system can nevertheless make more accurate classifications of patients? The answer to this problem is it has to do with robustness. Robustness means the ability of a strategy to generalize to new situations. For instance, the expert system is probably better than the fast and frugal tree on the original sample, which has been used to make the logistic regression. But this was a sample about 3,000 patients, but it's being applied in different hospitals where the patients slightly differ. So what one needs is not the method that it's most accurate with the original sample, but one needs to find someone that's less accurate with the original sample, but generalizes better. And a tree that just relies on the best strategies has a good chance to be robust in new situations. And here I would like to add an important point. One can try to search, to do Bayesian searches, for instance, for models, for new situations, and analyze them, and then construct some kind of tree. That's also possible. But in many real-world situations, we do not know what the next patients will look like. We do not know the future. And these heuristics, they bet on the future. They bet on the environment rather than analyze it. If they don't work, they can be revised. But here's an important difference. The fast and frugal tree consists of three building blocks. A search rule, it goes the order through these various criteria, various predictors. It has a very simple stopping rule. For instance, it can stop immediately up the first one. And it has a decision rule, which is also one reason decision making will base its decision only on one of these. What I'll show you now is that one can construct from the adaptive toolbox other heuristics. We are usually asked, how many heuristics are there, and isn't there a problem that there may be maybe 2 dozen, 3 dozen, 4 dozen? So our hope is to show that there is a smaller number of building blocks that can be used and accommodated to new situations. So I'll show you now a heuristic that we call take the best, which is not for a classification problem, like put a patient into one of two or more categories, but for a paired comparison problem, like which of two teams will win, where you make an inference which of two has a higher value on a criteria. And you will see that roughly the same building blocks can be used to for a quite different task. I will introduce this task with an example from sports. The task is the following. We want to predict the outcomes of baseball games. I'm sorry, having no data about cricket games. Baseball games on the basis of two predictors. One is a previous performance of a team, so the base rate of won games, and the other one is the halftime result, so the score at halftime. How would one do this? The obvious answer is Bayesian, use Bayes' rule. And that's one way we will consider. So Bayes' rule would have to calculate likelihood ratios for each difference at halftime, and the likelihood ratios will be the higher, the larger the differences. I will not go into these details here, but those of you who know Bayes' rule know it involves, even with two predictors, lots of computation. Alex Todorov has looked at, has tried to use take the best in order to predict the same games. The games were all games from the 1996-97 NBA season, about 1,200 games. Take the best looks at each of the predictors. It looks first at, like in the classification tree, it looks first at the number of games won. And the stopping rule is if the base rate difference is larger than 15, so the number of games these two teams have won, which is the case here, then that's enough for the frugal heuristic, and it stops search and concludes A will win the game. If the difference is not that big as here, 60-50, so they're not larger than 15, so it looks at the second queue, forgets the first one, and will bet on whatever team is ahead at halftime, in this case B. So that's I would just draw your attention to the fact that this heuristics either ignores the score at the halftime, or if it passes on here, it ignores the base rates. Exactly, doesn't matter whether it's how much is above 15 or how much longer. Both of these has been called errors, cognitive illusions. That is what most of us do all the time. We ignore base rates, and or we ignore the discriminative information. Now, the question is, if we now compare the performance of these simple heuristics with Bayes' rule, what do we get? Here, there are two questions. One is, how well do these two strategies describe actual people's judgments? And you can see, and this is no surprise, that take the best describes these judgments better. And if you do partial correlations, then we'll see that most of the explained variance is just here. The second question is, how accurate is a frugal heuristic compared to the complex Bayesian computations? Now you can make your bets. So Bayes' rule got 60.9% correct. And I should remind here that this is not data fitting. So Bayes' rule learned on one half of the data and made predictions for the other games. That's very important, because if you just do data fitting, you usually get, if you have more parameters and more sophisticated mathematical models, then you win. The truth is in prediction. So, how close did take the best come to the performance of Bayes' rule? Any guesses?
70.
I just remind you that this is in the literature and in all theories the best thing you can do. Yeah? Okay, and there's all this complicated computation. And we have a sample of 1,200 instances where you can fairly do good estimates. Huh? You can't do better. So take the best was as good. So here we have an instance where a fast and frugal heuristic in predictions about the actual world, and all the examples I give you today are from real world problems. They're not kind of tiny text problems. And here we have a situation where a simple lexicographic strategy is faster, more frugal, has very little computations, is also transparent, you can understand it, I have not even tried to explain your Bayes' rule, and is nevertheless as accurate and slightly better than the optimizing method. That should make us pause, for instance, to declare every violation of Bayes' rule as an era of reasoning, as it's still done in the cognitive psychology literature and also the behavioral economics literature. Everyone who deviates from the standard does something wrong. That's the irrational idea. When you test these models in real-world situations where there's tons of uncertainty, where you do not know whether the assumptions for either of these hold, then you can have this kind of surprises. Here are just a list of some of 20 more problems we have studied, and I'm not going into the individual problems. For instance, predicting homelessness rates in American cities, and professor salaries from several cues like gender, age, and rank, and so on. These are all problems of prediction, and we have tested Take the Best and its performance against optimization models. In this case, we had to do multiple regression, but some of these problems had so many predictors, there's no way to do Bayesian calculations. It just is computational explosion. So here is the performance of multiple regression. Over 20 data sets, there were on average 7.7 predictors. And multiple regression did some 68% correct predictions. That's again real prediction, not data fitting. Here's an interesting result that's known in the literature. If you do not use the optimal weights of multiple regression, but just use weights of plus one or minus one, you can actually do better, which is another instance. That's a known instance. That simplicity can pay off, that optimization is not the best thing to do, unless you already have constructed the environment yourself. Now, how well did Take the Best do? Remember that Take the Best only does limited search, so it will be more frugal. And here's the trade-off region that corresponds to the idea, if you have less information, then you have to pay some price for accuracy. So it should be in this region. So what comes out on the average, it's outside of the trade-off region, so it's both more frugal and more accurate. Again, the question is, how can this be? And to my knowledge, this has not been shown before, this result. And lexicographic strategies have been in the choice literature, where it's about preferences, always regretted in the sense that, yes, people do this, but it's the worst for them. And if you have preferences, you have no way to show that something could be actually better. With inferences, you can do this. The conditions under which a heuristic is successful and where not, this is the key questions of the program. I'm not proposing here that you should just be always fast and frugal and you will do the best thing in the world. So that's not the case. But the interesting question is, what structures can heuristics exploit and where would they fail? And here is one result. Here are situations with five cues, like five predictors. And here are two environments. In one environment, the predictors have cues like one, a half, a quarter, an eighth, and so on. And it's a binary situation to make it simple. And you can see that if Take the Best settles with this one or with that one, even if all other cues here would point to the other object, the sum of these cues could not be, the sum of these weights could not be larger than the one that Take the Best uses. In other words, one can prove that if such a structure exists, and this may be beta weights, just for illustration for those of you who are familiar with multiple regression. So if this structure exists, one can prove that there's no linear model that can do better than the much simpler Take the Best, to the degree that such a structure exists, it will more or less hold. Here's an example of a structure where Take the Best will fail. So if the weights are above the same, then a linear model that just adds up things will do better. Now, you might ask, how do people know which heuristic to use in an environment, if it's so important, the environmental structure. Here's one of our experimental studies where people were put in the position of a bank which can give a loan to one of two companies. And they get feedback which of these companies was the one that actually paid back the money, so which was a good decision. And the subjects have six predictors, which are typical predictors that are used by actual banks. So the trick here is that we have constructed two environments. In one, feedback is given by the non-compensatory structure and here by the compensatory structure. The subjects don't know anything about this. They just see, oh, this decision was wrong. Huh? The next one was right. And what do you see here? There are two groups of subjects which are basically at the same level at the beginning of users of take the best, about 30%. And during feedback, they go apart and they accommodate, on average, the use of a compensatory or non-compensatory structure so that it fits the environment without ever knowing about these things. Okay. So, let me go back to the classes of heuristics and I will give you one example at the end for ignorance-based decision making. This is in situations where one has very little information, and here is an example to illustrate the recognition heuristic. Now, which American city has more inhabitants, San Diego or San Antonio? Dan Goldstein and I asked this question and several other questions to students of the University of Chicago. These students got 62%, 62% of them got the answer correct, San Diego. They asked the same questions to German students. These German students knew very little about San Diego, and many of them had never heard of San Antonio. What proportion of the German students do you think got the right answer? More, but you only say this because I wouldn't give this example. Okay. here is the result. They all got it right. Now, how can this be? How can people who know less about a subject matter make more correct inferences than others who know more? The answer is that the American students, the answer is that the German students use the recognition heuristic. The recognition heuristic in this simple case is, if you've heard of one city but not of the other one, you bet that the first one is the larger one. Because there's usually a reason. You can't be fooled. None of these heuristics is foolproof. And the important question is now, again, the question of ecological rationality. When does this heuristic work and when would it fail? It works when ignorance is systematic rather than random. That is, when lack of recognition correlates with the criteria. And that's the case in many competitive situations. You've heard of some soccer teams, you've heard of some sports teams of some companies, and here is a little mathematics, and I will be short with this, where you can see how you can analyze even such a simple heuristic, and you can calculate the expected proportion of correct inferences of a whole series of either city comparisons of sports teams predictions or other kind of comparison like stock market. And the important thing which I just mentioned here is none of these values here is parameter fitting. They can all be directly estimated from the data. And one can predict a so-called less is more effect when under certain conditions. I'll just be short because of time on this. That means one can actually describe under which situations people with more knowledge will do less good than those with less knowledge. When this will happen, when this will not happen. Mm-hmm. And here is an experimental study that asked the question, do people actually use the recognition heuristic? These are individual persons. These are many, many trials. And what this means is the first person in 100
56 cases where he could use the recognition heuristic. He did it in every time, but as you see, there are some who don't use it as often, and overall, you get about 90% the cases where people confirm this. Now, there are more challenging questions. For instance, recognition heuristic is non-compensatory. So if you know something about one object, and which might go against the recognition heuristic, it's still the question, will it still follow it? For instance, Norway rats use the recognition heuristic when they make choices about food. So if there is one food they've tasted before, one food they've not tasted before, guess what they eat? They'll eat the first one. And you see the evolutionary rationale of this heuristic. Now, a more interesting situation, if they have smelled one food on the breath of a fellow rat, but not the other one, they still go with the one, the breath of the fellow rat, because on the assumption that the other rat knows what it does. And so that's, again, the recognition heuristic. And now the challenging situation is that Galef and others have studied is if we make the fellow rat sick at the time of the experiment, would the rat still go with the food that it smelled on the breath of the fellow rat who is sick, or try the unknown food? What do you guess? It still goes with recognition heuristic. Yeah? So recognition in this case dominates illness information, which is very challenging. Now we have done the same experiment with humans. Not with food, but with these city comparisons. So we have trained American students about knowledge about a powerful predictor of population size in cities they don't know very much about, German cities. And that's whether a city has a soccer team in the major league or not. So they knew that this was about the 30 largest cities, and many of them had soccer teams, others had not. And they were trained for a long time about learning, oh, this team, like Munich has a soccer team in the major league, Heidelberg does not. Such things. And after this training, which was only about soccer teams, the recognition was never mentioned, they were given crucial items, pairs. One, a city they had never recognized before the experiment, nor in the experiment. They only knew it's one in the top 30 big ones. Yeah? Like Bielefeld would be a good candidate. Compared to a city they recognized before the experiment, but they had learned it has no soccer team in the major league. So now we have the same situation as before, a recognized city, an unknown city, but we have now information about the recognized city that points in the other direction. So what would happen? Would the recognition hues decrease, or would humans behave like Norway rats? The answer is they behave like Norway rats. They, despite we trained them for an hour and taught them everything about soccer teams, they still went just with recognition. And as you can see, the same type of data, there are even half of them who always went with recognition in these critical items, and even when they knew that this city has no team in the soccer, team. When people use a heuristic, then there are others who exploit their use of the heuristic. Advertisement is a point in case. So the recognition heuristic plays its role in consumer choice. If you're in the supermarket and if you choose between two jams, one whose name you recognize, there's one you've never heard of, there's a good chance that you go with the one whose name you recognize and buy this one. Now, there are advertisement firms who exploit this fact. For instance, Benetton, in its advertisement campaign, gives you no information about the product, only tries to increase name recognition. The man behind the Benetton ads has also another political goal, which I'm not talk about here. But it's very clear from the success of Benetton that about 6 years ago they made it into the top five companies with name recognition worldwide, next to Kodak and Coca-Cola, based on this ad campaign, which tells you nothing about the product. It only bets on name recognition, Benetton, Benetton, Benetton. And here's an example about the social use of this heuristic. So some people use it, others will exploit the use to their own benefit. The last use of the recognition heuristic, and my last point today, is about the use of the recognition heuristic in the stock market. Now, I am lucky to have an interdisciplinary group at the Max Planck Institute, and there are mathematicians, computer scientists, psychologists, philosophers, one sociologist, but evolution biologists, but there are a few economists, and they ask a very pointed question at some point, yeah? Does the recognition heuristic make money? And so we put it on the stock market, and by now you should be able to understand how you use the recognition heuristic in the stock market. What you need are sufficiently ignorant people. So those who have not heard of all the stock names, it's just about name recognition, eh? But you also can't use those who have heard about no name, none of this. Yeah? So you need those who have heard about some. In a series of experiments, we interviewed pedestrians in downtown Chicago and asked them whether they've heard this or that of the stocks of the 500 Standard & Poor's. We asked pedestrians in downtown Munich, and we did a series of experiments which we have published. What I show you, to make things short, is a recent contest that we participated, which is simpler. The contest was issued by a German stock magazine called Kapital. So not Das Kapital, but Capital. And the editor-in-chief set the rules. The rules are 50 internet stocks, this was in the year 2000, and about 2 months' time, so a short time, and all trading on the internet so everyone could see how successful everyone else is. So we, Andreas Ortmann and I, decided to enter the recognition heuristic again. So how do you do this? We went down to the next public space and asked 100 pedestrians as an operationalization of sufficiently ignorant people, and gave them some money and asked them, look, here are 50 stock names. Just tell me one thing. Have you ever heard of this one?
No.
This one?
No.
This one? Yes, yes, yes. And so on. And then we took the 10 stocks with the highest recognition and entered it. You still need to follow other principles like diversification. Yeah? So 10. As a control, we entered the 10 least recognized, and on it goes. And we didn't do anything within the 2 months because recognition values don't change very much in this time. The editor-in-chief traded like a rabbit, and he had lots of insider knowledge which we did not have, and did much, much of trading. So what was the outcome of this? And I should say first, this was a down market. We had this large study we did before was a bull market, and I had put a considerable sum of my own money in it, and it was the most lucrative experiment I've ever did. But the critique was that it was a bull market, and many dear colleagues of mine said, you will never be able to replicate it. It's only in a bull market. Why escaped my knowledge, but even my dear co-author Reinhard Selten had the opinion that it's just a bull market. Anyhow. Now we hit a down market, and here are the results. What you see here, the returns, this is zero. The recognition heuristic portfolio made 2.5% gain, which was not bad in a short time and in a down market. The editor-in-chief of the magazine Capital made minus 18.5%, and our control portfolio was where it should be. You will not find this data published in the journal Capital. So let me round up. What I try to do today is to introduce you into the study of the adaptive toolbox. The adaptive toolbox is a Darwinian metaphor, a Darwinian notion of rationality in two senses. Namely, first, the heuristics are not general purpose. It's not like expected utility calculus. Yeah? They are middle-ranged, just like, and they are not designed from scratch. So they are like organs in a body. They've been evolved. And they are domain specific. They're not general. They just can do some jobs, not everything. For instance, the gaze heuristic you saw at the very beginning can be used for ball games, yes, but it can be used for a few other things. Basically, all situations where the interception of a moving object is involved. Yeah? For instance, when you learn to fly a plane and you sit in your Cessna in your first flight and tremble because you see another Cessna coming over there and fear a collision, then your flight instructor will instruct you with a very simple heuristic, which is the same heuristic as the gaze heuristic. It is, look at a scratch in your windshield and see whether the other plane moves relative to that scratch. If it does not, dive away quickly. And you can see, if it does not, it will land exactly there. And you don't want to do this. The instructor will not tell you to compute the trajectory of your own plane in four-dimensional space, including time, and estimate the trajectory of the other plane in the same space and see whether there is a meeting point. So the heuristic, this is the range of the heuristic, but it's not general. It's not useful for making stock investments, for instance. So, and this is something that many people have to have difficulties with. The Leibnizian dream, the Leibnizian dream of the universal calculus is so deeply entrenched to many economists, philosophers, and cognitive scientists that the idea of an adaptive toolbox with this messy assembly of heuristics and the building blocks provides a problem to many. So what I talked today about is the building blocks of heuristics like search rules, stopping rules, and decision rules, the importance of frugality in many decisions, and also the importance of transparency, such as in the example about doctors' decision making. And ecological rationality is the science about where heuristics work and where they do not work. And here we have the structure of environments. I gave you one example about the compensatory and the non-compensatory structures, the green and the red ones. The second reason is robustness. That is, structures in an uncertain world, simplicity can pay off. Because if you have two complex models, they will not easily channelize. And finally, a channel principle that in many situations, less is more. And let me conclude with the following. Optimization and omniscience are beautiful fictions. They are mathematically elegant, and they draw many of us into mathematics, and we love to design models of logic, of utility maximization, and other kind of calculi. However, I think there is another sense of beauty, and this sense is a sense of wonder in how simplicity can produce robustness and accuracy in an overwhelming complex world. The gaze heuristic, the recognition heuristic, take the best, fast and frugal classification are all examples about how heuristics can produce this sense of wonder. Thank you.
Got a wonderful lecture. Daniel Reed is going to make a brief commentary on the principle that less is more.
I will indeed make a. I think I'll just pass on the slides. Yeah, I'll just say a few words because I know that you're very eager to get to ask Professor Giger answer some questions. And actually, Professor Humphrey here instructed me to spend no more than 5 minutes on this discussion. Many discussions, he told me, go on and on for a long time about their research and tell you all types of things you don't really want to know about. And I promise you, I will not do the former. I'm not going to. I won't do that. I won't tell you about my research. And also, I think he was worried that I would make you forget Professor Gingerenzer's talk. I think you'll agree that that's pretty unlikely. So I think no fear on either count. Just want to point to a couple of things I think are pretty important. I really wonder if I could show. I can't. I just wanted to say a couple of things I think are important. One of them is about the concept of rationality. And one of the things I really like about. One of the things I really like about the work that Professor Gingerenzer has done, or is doing, so it's not going to happen, right?
Well, the screen's gone off. So
it's okay. Yeah. Is that an emphasis is put not just on rationality as a way of getting to a particular kind of goal, but also on the fact that efficiency, doing things really efficiently and well, is part itself of rationality. Professor Gingerenzer talks about fast and frugal heuristics. And frugality is part of rationality. From an evolutionary point of view, you shouldn't waste a lot of time or resources doing something that isn't going to do you very much good. And I think there has been a kind of tendency amongst people, well, perhaps like myself, but people in the field of judgment decision making, to look at isolated events, such as people making one kind of mistake, perhaps failing to use Bayes' rule in a certain situation, and infer from that people are irrational in this kind of context. But what we always have to be thinking about is these people's, what did they use the resources that they could have used to learn Bayes' rule on instead? If they used it to do something else, such as reproduce or eat, which leads eventually to reproduction, then perhaps they were doing something more rational than learning how to solve probability problems. And I think really that's one of the things I really take from this kind of work. The other thing, perhaps a slightly more, slightly more critical point of view, is I'm not sure I entirely agree with the distinction between demons and bounded rationality. When I think about rationality, I think that there are sort of two ways of looking at it. One of them, or actually I should say look at when I think about people's thinking and decision making, we can look at it from a kind of normative point of view. We say, okay, this is kind of what we would like people's behavior to look like if they were really ideally rational. And then we kind of look at it from a kind of descriptive point of view. And we really hope that those things coincide. And I think that demons are normative, what we call normative. It's a description of how we want the world to be. Bounded rationality is a description of how the world is. I think Professor Gingerenzer is saying that these two things are in fact the same. That the demon and the bounded rationality essentially come up with the same thing. They're both rational. So I had a slide to show you, but I won't bother for obvious technical reasons. Just one other thing I want to do is I take the right of asking a question. And one thing I wonder, and I know that you've spoken about this before, is I wonder what relationship you see between the judgment processes you describe and the physical mind or brain or body or whatever it is that we see instantiating thought. Do you think that there is, for instance, a recognition heuristic or a take the best heuristic module in the body that kind of is automatically activated when we're born? Or do you think that we're kind of like general purpose decision makers who acquire these heuristics over time? So in some sense, when we evolve to be take the best thinkers or recognition thinkers? Well, you think you might have implied that we are recognition thinkers, or do we in fact learn this over time, and could we learn to do different things? Kind of what I was thinking of is, suppose we ended up in Mars, and Mars had a compensatory world rather than a non-compensatory world, would we be able to function on Mars? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's hopefully within the time frame required. Thank you.
Well, I think we should answer that
big question
that
about
leading
Mars.
Question at the end there. Yes.
Okay. The question about Mars. The question is,
one which I did not address. So where do heuristics come from? Yeah? Are they evolved? Are they genetically coded? Are they learned? Where do they come from? There are examples of heuristics which seem to be genetically coded, like the example I gave is Norway rats and their food choice. There are examples for take the best, which are genetically coded, which it looks like. For instance, the way female guppies, these are little fishes, make mate choices. The males are smaller and very colorful. And according to the biological literature, this is not my own research, the female guppies seem to do something just like take the best. If they choose between two males, and they seem to go through sequentially through criteria, the most important seems to be how orange the male is, so in their fins and so on, body. And if one is considerably more orange than the other one, that's it. Yeah? If they're about the same, or if the female cannot discriminate, I think we do not know exactly which one, then a second criterion is looked up, so like search and stopping, which is an interesting one because it's a social cue. It's a mate copying. So that means if the female has seen another female, yeah, a mating with this male, but the other male, she has not seen one, she goes with the one that the other female also wanted. And that's not so unhuman, this strategy. So here are some examples where we have some evidence that some of these heuristics are somehow genetically imprinted, but I don't think that anyone understands how this really works. Heuristics like the gaze heuristic, I would assume that they are being learned by observational learning. So you observe a player, and for instance, you see that the players catch a ball while running. That wouldn't happen if you would compute where it's coming down and then walk there. Huh? And so, and also some of these experiments we have done, and only showed one here, is that one can, when one changes environments, one can change people's heuristics. So they seem to learn on the spot. But in general, it's a field where we know only the beginning with some experiments, and it would be great if there would be more people who would join this research.
Thanks. We're now going to open the discussion for questions. There are some microphones around, I hope. Who has them? Tilly has one down there. And so put up your hand, and there's another. I think there's another microphone over that side, I hope. Is there? Let's take that one. Could you speak into that?
Yeah.
And then we'll use this one. Why don't you
go to the one? The lady in just beside you.
It seems to me that your program requires a second order of heuristics. So there is, in addition to the panoply of heuristics, a set of environments which are the most appropriate fit to those heuristics. So one should have heuristics that would decide which decision heuristic is appropriate. You gave one case in which people seem to very quickly learn, the bank lending example, which environment is compensatory, which non. But do you know which heuristics they use to distinguish which environment is which?
No, that's a very good question. I would only want to know the complete answer to it. So we know that what we know is, the question is, do people use heuristics to choose between heuristics? Hmm? There's another question that I often get is, don't you need an optimizing daemon to choose between heuristics? So the Bayesian daemon who, I extend this question at the moment, the Bayesian daemon who decides it's better not to do Bayes, but say, fast and fluid classification. My answer to this version is no, because then we are just in the same game as before. Your question about heuristics for choosing heuristics, this is much more to my heart. But we have not studied this. We have studied situations where people respond to changes, feedback changes, in environments, and here we know that the heuristics are adapted. Also, the problem about choosing between heuristics is less large than one might think, because the heuristics are domain-specific. They do not work in many situations. So take the best, it's for paired comparisons. It would not work for classification problems. But if you allow me another 2 years of research, I think I may have identified some of the heuristics to choose heuristics.
Peter has it there.
You made a very good case for how simple heuristics can do very well. I think you made that very clear indeed. Perhaps what you've also done is you've shown how statistical methods can fail, and perhaps when they're not used to in the best possible way.
Yeah.
In particular, there's a classic problem, what's called overfitting in any kind of statistical modeling or neural network modeling, and it seems to me that might be what's happening in some of your examples, particularly the baseball example. What you have is, if you like, a classifier where you have two inputs, and you want to, from those two inputs, make a best possible classification. Now, what I would have liked to see for that is a two-dimensional plot of what the Bayesian classifier that you use actually gave for the classification, that's to say which team is going to win as a function of the two variables.
Yeah.
And I feel that perhaps, it depends, of course, what that would have given you, but how do you constrain that to have a simple boundary fitted to suitable smoothness constraint or something of that sort? You may have found that the statistical model actually did very well there. Did you try that?
Yeah, so your remark is about the general issue of overfitting, and which is the flip side of robustness. So a method that is robust doesn't overfit, and vice versa. Just to try to explain this concept, because it's a very important one. So for instance, if you have one data set or one set of experience or your past world, where you have two models, and one explains your experience or data better than the other one, but the one that explains it better has also more free parameters. You have all kind of extra stories to it. So, and overfitting happens if you apply this, what you know, to a new sample, to the new world, to the future, and then the model who did better does less well than the model who was simpler and did not so good. And this is an enormously important concept, and I'm very grateful for this question, because much of hypothesis testing in economics, in cognitive sciences, including neural networks you mentioned there, is only about data fitting. You have your data, and you show that this model explains more variance than the other one. And one can argue, when one takes a very strong opinion, that data fitting is not a good method for hypothesis testing for this kind of reason, because you have no control about overfitting. And so in another sense, the general lesson that one can take out of this is, if you want to make good decisions under uncertainty, and this is where overfitting comes in, if you're in a certain world, there's no overfitting. So if you want to make good decisions under uncertainty, you have to ignore part of the information you have. And I repeat this. If you want to make good decisions under uncertainty, you must ignore part of the information. And the only question is which part to ignore. And here's the art, to find a method that ignores the right part of the information. So the overfitting is an enormously important concept. And neural networks is, for instance, in the standard Bible of neural networks by Rumelhardt and McClelland, you might look at this. I can't tell from heart, but I would guess that most, if not all, of this study just involve fitting and not prediction. And also neural networks can get a nervous breakdown when they're applied to new situations. Thanks for this.
Question there from the middle. No, well, I was going to. You're there, I think. And you can come afterwards.
Sorry, I wanted to suggest the virtues of what we can call the Columbia economist heuristic, or the let's be serious heuristic. And if we think of your examples, I mean, so you're in general, you're rather optimistic, as the introduction to your talk suggests. You're rather optimistic about the success with which people reason using fairly simple decision, heuristic decision structures. And many of your examples are about things which have not been of great, are more illustrative than important in themselves. The one that decision theorists have been most interested in to the point of trying to find ways to make better decisions is the medical one. And that is the one unmistakable case where, on the one hand, at least if we're to believe your heart attack example, there are good heuristics, and the doctors have not found them. In the case where there's been really a lot of study, your optimism kind of breaks down. It's not just that the doctors can't do it because there aren't any good heuristics. The doctors can't do it even though there are good heuristics, which your heuristics sounded reasonably plausible. I just wonder what you have to say. Well, so one possibility is, in fact, that where we are serious, as the Columbia economist urges us, we don't actually find as much rationality as we seem to find when we talk about guessing the size of American cities, where we probably don't care so much. I just wonder supposing there are heuristics, is it something singularly excellent about doctors that they're incapable of finding them, or do you have some other explanation for where the heuristics are actually, where we actually behave rationally, and where we kill people?
Okay, so I think that Ted Porter's argument is the following, that the success of the heuristics is due that we looked at a population which is somehow stupid, like doctors, right? And could it be in could the heuristics also work with more reasonable people? Not his argument. Okay, I'll take to be this. This is what I understood, and you can explain me later what you think. So, does it work anywhere else? Now, I have given you an example about stock market, and these are financial advisors. I don't know in which category you put them. If you would have looked more closely to this table of problems that I had here, like predicting homelessness rates, dropout rates in Chicago schools, you may say that's all not important problems, but this is a matter of taste. So we have studied quite a number of problems, economic problems and others, where we can see the same problems. And it has little to do with what type of problem. This has to do with issues like robustness, overfitting, structure of environments, and the degree of uncertainty in a problem. So I still think that it's not just a matter of doctors.
No, I want to try a more general version. It might
can you keep it quick, though, because we've got about 10 minutes left for questions.
It might be that where there's actually been lots of interest of social scientists and others in studying how people make decisions in important cases like medicine, even though there might be heuristics available which they can find, but the doctors, that is, the spontaneous actors don't find them. So that is, I'm suggesting, maybe when you look really closely and when you really worry about good decisions in important cases, you do not support, your research doesn't support the kind of optimism which you seem to hold up in general.
Okay, what I understand at the moment is that you're saying that the doctors use heuristics, but they use somehow bad heuristics. And that's actually, I think, in part true. And the doctors use very different strategies, and it has to do because they are typically trained to believe in complex systems, like expert systems. And for instance, some of the doctors told me after these results were known that simple heuristics can do as good or better than this expert system, that they have used in secret certain kinds of heuristics, but were not admitting it because they could be liable and for other reasons. Is this an answer?
So next question, I think we'll move on to. Can keep it quite short if you can.
Maybe it's a bit related. I thought that the attraction of heuristics on optimization is that it's accessible to people. Now, the example of the doctors would, in fact, indicate it's not so accessible, and in fact the heuristic you showed seems to be quite complex. I mean, it's complex that it's simple when you put it up. The question is, how did you come to it? It seems to reflect really the causal factors of this problem, and the question is then finding these heuristics might be a quite complex problem.
Yeah. So there are two ways to construct heuristics. One is actually a way that you would, for instance, run through all possible simple trees, a Bayesian algorithm, which you can't do, but you do some kind of, and find in the restricted set the best one. That's known. And then you have a simple heuristic, but no process, no simple process to get it. In this example, another way was done. So, and I didn't explain how this medical heuristic was constructed. The answer is that it was constructed in the following way. One takes the predictor out of this huge expert system, which has the highest sensitivity, that minimizes misses. And then one takes the next one, which has the highest specificity, which minimizes false alarms, and so on. So it's a very quite simple criterion, which ignores dependencies between the variables, because the conditional specificity may not be the same as the single specificity, but that's the way it was constructed. And of course, you have to bet somehow on the environment doing this. And you're not sure that you're getting the best one. But there is no certainty anyhow.
Next question.
So you said that we do better when we use fast and frugal heuristics than when we use, say, probability calculus. And there is a question about what you mean when you say better there. So there is a question about what is the standard by means of which we judge different strategies. And so it is a thought. Suppose I want to maximize my utility. What do I do? I believe everything you said, so I use simple, fast and frugal heuristics. What does this mean? This thought seems to suggest that fast and frugal heuristics are the best means to maximize utility, and that perhaps it's for that reason that we won't call them rational or more rational than other means that we may use in order to decide what to do.
Hmm. Yeah, an economist defense. The first short answer. I do not want to suggest that simple heuristics are always better. It's exactly not my message. The message is that one needs to analyze the structure, then one can show that in certain situations they're better, and otherwise they may not be better. Second, and also an answer again to Ted's question, for instance, the doctors used heuristics, but they used heuristics that were not very good. That's all possible. Your question, what does better mean? Now, in these examples, I talked today about four different criteria. So making a decision fast, which is often very important, or even making a decision at all. One should not underestimate this. Making a decision with limited knowledge. We usually are in situations where we have only little knowledge about what we are deciding. Transparency and accuracy. The criteria I have not mentioned are truth, consistency. And I think they are secondary criteria.
I think we'll have two more questions because we don't want to cut the party short.
I wanted to question what seems to me the foundation of your work, not the central ideas, which I think are very valuable and stimulating, but the idea that the brain is rational, works in a rational way, even if it's boundedly rational, which seems to me an assumption you share with the, as I understand it, with the cognitive sciences. And by rational, I mean that it's in some way like a computer program, so that it follows an ordered, rule-based, step-by-step reasoning. If you look at the standard program, it's, let's say, ordered, organized, consistent, coherent, purposeful, focused. Now, I would suggest if you look at any actual stream of human thought about any problem, when you sit down and think about a personal problem, when a person actually thinks about an investment decision vis-a-vis the stock market, I would take the archetypal thing I would say is take student essays. You'll find that human thinking is naturally, to some extent, disordered, disorganized, inconsistent, incoherent, lacks a goal, loses sight of the goal. This is natural. In other words, to be rational is always an effort. Yes, we are capable of rationality, but it is always an effort. So the fundamental assumption, as I understand it, of cognitive sciences is wrong. And it's terrible, it has immense practical importance, because to be a skilled thinker, you have to develop order, organization, etc. Now, the reason for it strikes me... Sorry, can I just finish? Okay, just coming to the reason why I think the brain is this way, you have a very... Your adaptive toolbox is useful in that sense, that the brain has a whole set of heuristics, a whole set of strategies and tactics. It has major problems choosing between them, and also other problems on its mind.
Okay, the models, these are models of heuristics and, of course, generalizations. Yeah? And you are certainly correct that many people, in many situations we muddle through things. And I won't just mention, but nevertheless, I think we have good evidence, and experimental evidence, and also evidence from simulations, that there is some order in this reasoning. And even if we cannot explain every person's judgment exactly, we are getting at the basic structure. One last remark, consistency and coherence is not so important. I mentioned this before for this heuristic. Some of the heuristics we study, they produce intransitive judgments. But that doesn't imply that they're not as accurate as other strategies who do not.
I think, for you, I'm going to stop it there. You've been up since very early this morning. And one of the reasons why Gerd Gigerenzo was up this morning was to advertise his book on Radio 4 this morning, his new book, this is, which is called Reckoning with Risk, Learning to Live with Uncertainty. That book is on sale outside outside in the foyer there, and if you don't want to pay for it, I'll deal with it then, though. The publisher, Penguin, are going to have a stall upstairs in the senior common room where the reception is. And maybe I'll persuade Gerd to sign the copy for you. I want to say that this reception, which we can all now go to, is made possible by generosity of Stickard and Operations Research, which went in with CPNSS in organizing this wonderful lecture. We're very grateful to them for doing that. So now let's move upstairs, and I hope as many of you can will come up there to the fifth floor, to the senior combination room. And thank you very much indeed.